Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your live connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Guys, today's show is a very special show with a very special guest, and I'm honored he has agreed to join us for what I'm sure is going to be a very enlightening and potentially life-changing conversation. I, Lisa Berry, am all about love and laughter and, of course, learning. I'm big-hearted and light-hearted. I love to laugh and do what I can to help others have a better day. But today we're going to be talking about the brain. And our special guest is Dr. Rudy Tanzi. He is a professor of neurology at Harvard University Medical School, director of the Genetics and Aging Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital, co-author of the New York Times bestseller Super Brain with Deepak Chopra, also a noted musician. We've got to throw that in there. He's professionally played keyboards, most recently with Joe Perry and Aerosmith. And hosted a Super Brain special on PBS. And I could go on, but we'd be out of time. So I'm officially going to welcome Dr. Rudy Tanzi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me. It's thrilled to start this discussion.
It's going to be I've followed you. I actually got my copy of Super Brain from Deepak when he was in the Detroit area. That's where this show is coming from. And, of course, I've followed you. You're a renowned genetic researcher. You've made some important discoveries concerning Alzheimer's, and we hope to talk about that. But let's get started with some important thoughts that you have about our brain. How did you even first get interested in studying the brain?
Well, you know, I was always interested in just, you know, the mysteries of the brain. I guess to this day I still wonder how you can have, you know, 100 billion nerve cells making up to a quadrillion connections, and somehow this one organ brings you your whole world. It's like a projector, you know, projecting your world onto a screen, which you call your mind. And we take it for granted, but that's a pretty amazing thing for, you know, just a bunch of Jell-O, 3 pounds of Jell-O sitting in your skull to do. So I've always been amazed by it.
Well, see, you're a brain-focused person, and I'm a heartfelt person. So can we do we see things the same way or feel things the same way, or how do you, and from your perspective, think we look at the world?
Well, I think that they're very much similar. I mean, you know, when you're feeling things in your heart, your brain is still projecting that to you. I mean, if your brain's not turned on, you could say you couldn't appreciate what your heart is bringing you. So even feelings of love and just, you know, good feelings about the world, kindness, the types of values that we try to instill in ourselves and our families and loved ones, you know, your brain is projecting that to you as well. I mean, the amazing thing is your brain brings you your world. We take it for granted, but here's 3 pounds of Jell-O-like material sitting in pitch darkness, complete silence in your skull, and it projects this amazing world to you that can be a great place, a terrible place, or a thrilling place, or a boring place. It's really up to you because your brain is yours. It's your tool. It's your ally, your best friend. And when we wrote Superbrain, we thought, hey, let's write a user's manual for the brain. Let's tell people how they can use their brain, reminding them that you're not just your brain, that the brain is an organ that serves you. The real you is the person that's aware of having a brain and saying, how can I use my brain in the best way?
So that is such a, you know, I never thought of it that way because I feel things from my heart. I'm very intuitive, party emotional, but I never thought that those feelings were processing through my brain before I was actually experiencing them. So that is an interesting way to look at it. We're talking to Dr. Rudy Tanzi, distinguished researcher out of Harvard and co-author of Super Brain with Deepak Chopra. And one of the biggest points of the book is how to use your brain instead of using it. So please help us in that area.
Yeah, the idea is to ask yourself at any moment of the day, whenever you can, am I using my brain or is my brain using me? Mm-hmm. So an example is if something happens that upsets you,
right.
And now you have you're angry and you can't control it. You know, I'm thinking about my 6-year-old daughter at breakfast this morning. You know, and I actually tell my 6-year-old daughter, I said, now, is that your brain using you or are you using your brain? and so, you know, the way it works is that the oldest part of your brain is instinctive, right? It's going to make you want to eat food. It's going to make you want to fight or run away. It's what drives the survival of the species. It's all just instinct, programmed to memory. It's why, you know, as soon as you're born, you know that you have to go to your mother's breast and drink milk. It's, you don't need to learn these memories. They're programmed. That same part of the brain can get you in trouble because it can make you fiery. It can make you want to fight. It can make you want to just hide and not be part of the world. So the instinctive parts of the brain are very strong, and they always try to dominate because, hey, they were there first. 400 million years ago, that part of the brain evolved. We call it the reptilian brain. And if we fast forward ahead to what part of the brain is evolving fastest right now, we get to what you were talking about, the heart, intuition, empathy, altruism, being part of a community where it's more important to serve others and help the whole species rise rather than just thinking like a lizard who says, I'm all for myself and get out of my way. So the original old brain, you know, just said, hey, we got to keep this species going. Make sure they take care of themselves. As the brains evolved, we're entering a phase of, and I'm very optimistic, a phase of empathy, altruism, and kindness and service. And that includes intuition and feeling what others need. You know, I mean, essentially getting back to the golden rule. Is this good? You know, what's good for me is what I should do for others. And so I think this is all part of the brain's evolution, and we feel it in different ways. So you have on one extreme instinct on the one end and intuition on the other, and in the middle you have emotion and intellect. And the key is how can you integrate all four of those, the instinctive brain that keeps you going, the emotional brain gives you passion, the intellectual brain that gives you creativity, sense of self, and now intuition, the intuitive brain that helps us connect better with each other and drive the species into higher levels of productivity and success.
Mm-hmm. I love to hear that. I'm using my brain because we grew up with three sisters in my family, and the oldest one was the pretty one, and the next one was the smart one, and I was the funny, emotional one. But so that is part of my brain that I'm using, and I'm glad to hear that you think that that is being developed, because sometimes when you get in your car and you drive in traffic, you don't see that out in the world very much. But that's what I'm trying to be. That's what I'm trying to be a part of improving that in our world. And I'm glad to hear that that's actually a part of our brain, and you think that's evolving in society right now.
Yeah, but remember that it's always, you know, the programmed memories and the parts of the brain that are oldest are going to be the strongest. So it's harder to be creative and intellectual. It's easier to be emotional. It's even easier to be just having base instincts drive you. Never mind where you've gone in your own evolution toward feeling from the heart, intuition, love, kindness, service, which is the newest and toughest to do. But if you want to drive your own evolution, observe what's going on in your brain. Just ask yourself, am I being instinctive right now? Where am I in my brain right now? I'm the user. I'm in charge here. This is my brain. Just like my stomach serves me and digests my food, my brain's bringing me my world. But, hey, I'm watching your brain, and I'm going to make sure you bring me the world I want to live in.
So that's where self-awareness comes in, being aware of yourself and your brain and how you're acting. And you're saying you can control that?
Yeah, so we're careful not to use the word control.
Okay.
We're saying that you could say it's in your control, but the way it's in your control is to not try to control it. It's interesting. Whenever you try to control anything,
right,
in biology,
I'm confused.
No,
right.
No. Whenever you try to control anything or resistance, there's always persistence. So what we say is that the way to so first of all, self-awareness, which is a very new thing for the brain. Relatively speaking, that's only about 4 million years old. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
All right.
Think about your cat. Think about your cat looking in the mirror, right? Does the cat look at himself in the mirror and say, oh, how great I look right now, right? The cat doesn't know it's seeing itself in the mirror, right? And
right.
The cat's pretty evolved, but still doesn't know. It's only over the last 4 million years, over, you know, as going into primates and us, that you have the brain is allowing us to be aware of self. So the brain's needed to be aware of self, but once you're aware of self, you can say, hey, the real me is, you know, this self inside. Call it the light. Call it the energy of life. Call it what you want, the soul. But that's the real self is now using the brain, and for the first time in evolution, just over the last 4 million years, where the brain's been evolving for about 400 million years, you're able to realize, I have a brain. That's my brain. How do I use it? And so that's the key. And self-awareness allows you to do the following one thing, and this is all you need to do. It's very simple. Observe. Simply sit back whenever you can and observe, what is your brain doing? Is your brain being instinctive? Are you in your brain stem right now? Is it fight or flight? Should I attack or should I retreat? Do I just want to eat or consume? Do I just want to go out and see if I can find someone to bring home tonight? You know, all those base instincts. Is that where you are? Is it just emotional? Are you just dealing with fears and desires all the time and that part of the brain that's only 100 million years old called the limbic system? Fear, desire, emotion. And are you just intellectual? I know plenty of people who think they're so cool because they're just intellectual. They're living in that 4 million-year-old neocortex and saying, well, as long as I'm intellectual, I'm not emotional. I'm way above everybody. And what happens with them is they teeter-totter back and forth between that instinctive brain of fight and flight and the intellectual brain, and they're not very pleasant to be in a room with. So, and then you have folks who are very intuitive, who are very, very nice to be around. The key is you want all four to work for you, all parts of those brains. You don't want to control or deny any of them. But simply by observing what's going on in the brain, you're allowing that self-aware you to integrate those parts of the brain and get them talking to each other. So the key is not activity of the brain, how much of my brain am I using. We actually use all of our brain. The key is connectivity. How many parts of my brain am I connecting right now? And that's where we have to do a lot of work to use our brains.
And
to connect, you observe. That's all.
So you're observing, but you don't like the word control, so you're observing. That's being self-aware. I mean, people want to, what can I do? Can I take a pill? Should I meditate? How do I make them all balanced and connect at the same time so I am the well-rounded person?
So by observing, you're sitting back and just literally you're going back. You're thinking about yourself as an observer, as the witness. So I call it, I borrow this term from, there was a person who started a monastery in Kauai. It was a Hindu monastery, and he wrote a series of books. Subramanya Swami was the original writer. He passed away at the turn of the century. But he used this term I really like, called mountaintop consciousness. Mountaintop consciousness. He would actually bring the trainees up onto a mountain to teach them this. So the idea is that self-awareness, you're sitting on the mountaintop, and you're looking down at your brain. Okay, so now this puts you into the true self inside. That's not just a bunch of activities, in the brain. It's not just a slew of emotions and thoughts in the brain that the brain is producing for you. And you're looking down and saying, what's my brain doing right now? Is there a certain emotion right now? Am I jealous? Am I happy? Is it just an emotional experience right now? Is there verbal dialogue? Are there words going through my head? Some type of internal monologue or dialogue? Am I feeling just super hungry and that's all I can think of? Am I angry? So in other words, you sit on that mountaintop where self really is, and you look down at the brain and say, what's my brain doing right now? And in this way, rather than your brain using you, you're using your brain. So I think a good example is, think about, you look at a lemon, right? When you look at a lemon, what's happening, right? When you look at a lemon, what's happening is that photons are bouncing off the lemon, and, light, it's hitting your eye, and then there are receptors, photoreceptors in your eye, that transmit just electrochemical signals to your brain, and your brain produces for you this color yellow, the shape of the lemon, right? And now you're seeing a lemon. And what you say is, I see a lemon. My brain is producing for me the vision of a lemon. Now, the brain brings you four different things. I'm using, the excellent analogy that Dan Siegel from UCLA, who's written tremendous books. I highly recommend anything he's written, neuropsychiatrist from UCLA. And Dan Siegel says the brain brings you four things: sensations, images, and you can actually say images are part of sensations, and sensations including all the things your senses bring you, but sensations, images, feelings and thoughts. That's what the brain brings you from the outside world. So when you see a lemon, you're happy to say, I see a lemon. And you know your brain is bringing you the image of a lemon. Okay? Now, let's say someone takes that lemon, someone takes this lemon and hums it at your head and bangs you off the head with a lemon. Right? You're going to feel the pain. You're going to feel pain by a different set of receptors. And then what's going to happen is you're going to get upset. And now you would say, because you got hit in the head with a lemon, I am angry. I am angry. And I would argue, we would argue in the book, that's as foolish as saying, I am a lemon. Your brain brought you the feeling of anger. Again, just like your brain delivered you through electrochemical signals the image of a lemon, when that lemon hits you in the head after feeling pain, your brain brought you that feeling of anger. And when the correct thing to say is not, I am angry. That's like saying, because I see a lemon, I am a lemon. You know, my brain, right now, my brain is making me feel anger. And you observe that rather than live in it. And next thing you know, you're over that anger, and you can be constructive and proactive rather than go into a hissy fit for the next hour.
And why waste an hour of your life? Okay, well, when I stopped, I sat on the mountaintop, and I looked at my brain. I am just, and this will be an interesting response, I'm such a feeling, emotion-type person. I'm feeling all these feelings right now. So to step outside myself and observe those feelings, well, don't I kind of want to feel them? I'm ecstatic that I'm having this wonderful conversation with you. I'm looking out the window at a beautiful tree and a bluebird, and I feel like I'm feeling that in my heart, not my brain. So you're saying to observe it.
Well, you're feeling. You have to. You know, the thing is, how are you defining feeling right now? You're feeling one with the world. I mean.
Right.
You can argue that the feeling you have is actually because you're dwelling in the true self all the time. And that's what, you know, when you appreciate most the great things about the world, goodness, love, kindness, here to serve others, I mean, this is where the true self is. And so you could argue that that's not just a single emotion brought to you by your limbic system, that it's actually a feeling of integration with self and the world, and it feels really good because you never feel better than when you're integrated with yourself or you're being self-aware. So, you know, enjoy that feeling. I mean, absolutely. And your emotional brain is allowing you to experience it. But by observing it, you can also appreciate it more. By observing it, you're also allowing that intellectual brain to know what's going on. And next thing you know, that might be inspiring new creative thoughts and new creative mechanisms for how you express yourself and what you're going to do for your world with that feeling.
That's exactly where I am right now. So one of the things that you were talking about, I'm talking to Dr. Rudy Tanzi, and co-author of Superbrain, and one of the things you address in the book with Deepak Chopra is how to overcome emotion. So the good part of my emotions are happening right now, but I think being this sensitive sometimes, and I shouldn't be just talking about myself, but to anyone who has a negative emotion, you're saying just to observe them. But you can take that further, can't you, if you have some more serious problems, you want to lose weight or if you want to deal with anxiety? Is it all about just observing those emotions?
Observation is the first step. So I guess the idea is that once you retreat into the true self, this mountaintop consciousness, and you observe, you know, where am I going in my mind right now? Where is my brain bringing me? Why do I really want to eat? I'm hungry right now. First, observe the fact that you're hungry, right? Then ask yourself, you know, why am I hungry right now? Is it really my stomach that's empty? Do I feel like my stomach needs food? Does it feel empty down there? Or am I just nervous? Am I anxious? And if I eat, the reward and pleasure of eating is going to make me feel better. So the process starts with observation, and then it becomes a process of realization. But to realize what's going on in your body and your brain right now, you have to start with observation. And that means from a very quiet, you know, quieting your mind, trying to retreat into the self, sit on that mountaintop and say, what's going on right now? And the more often you can do that, I think the fuller you can live life, because you're not denying your brain from doing anything that it wants to do. But by observing it, you're allowing that your brain to serve you and integrate. So I like to use this this term of the three Ds, where basically you've got the drive of your brainstem, the drive for survival, that's the first D, the desire to do things, you know, the passion, the second D, that comes from that 100-million-year-old limbic system. That first D drive comes that 400-million-year-old instinctive reptilian brain in the back and the brainstem. And then the third D is dream, and that's that 4-million-years-old new part of the brain, the cortex in the front, where the dream is the ability to have vision, to have purpose, have a sense of self and creativity. And when you have those, and I call it the 3D brain, and when you have those 3Ds working together, you know, this is where you get people like Da Vinci and Mozart, Galileo, where they weren't just intellectual, they weren't just drive, they had it all going on. They had the motivation and drive from the instinctual brain that says go, go, go. They had that passion to really persevere and do and achieve that comes from that limbic brain. And they had the ability to dream in that newest part of the brain that gives us a sense of self and the ability to be creative. And so the idea is when you observe what's going on in your brain, you're causing these areas to integrate. And then it's a process of just realization from there of where you want to go.
Can anyone become a Da Vinci? I always feel, and I am by no means the accomplished researcher that you are, but I always feel when I meet people, either they're wired, their brains are wired a certain way, or their genetics make them who they are. And I feel like great accomplished artists like that has to do with genetics. But you're the expert. You tell me.
Well, okay. So your brain is rewiring itself all the time. So, you know, as your brain develops from when you're an infant, from when you're in when you're an embryo, it's wiring a certain way, and there are certain aspects that are hardwired, like what allows you to breathe and have a heartbeat, you know, the autonomic nervous system, as it's called. But the brain that's you, your personality brain, your emotions, your intellect, your feelings and thoughts, etc., it's rewiring all the time. Just as we speak and we're listening to each other, my neural networks are changing. My synaptic connections, my pathways are changing right now just having this discussion. So the first, you know, big aspect that we speak about regarding the brain in the book is that the brain is highly plastic and flexible, dynamic. It rewires all the time. So the fact is if you allow it to, your brain can learn anything. But you bring in genetics, and actually Deepak and I are writing the follow-up book to Superbrain now called Super Genes, where we talk about this. My day job is I'm a geneticist. I discovered many of the known Alzheimer's genes, the first Alzheimer's disease gene. And so from the genetic standpoint, yes, you're born with a certain genetic predisposition towards certain behaviors or diseases or talents. But there's something called epigenetics, and that means gene activity. So you have these 25,000 or so genes, and their activity can be up or down. Well, your lifestyle, your attitude, your perspective, your outlook, the things you expose yourself into your life, your interactions with friends, everything is affecting your gene activity all the time. So even though you were dealt certain DNA from your parents that predispose you to certain personality traits or certain diseases, et cetera, with your lifestyle, in most cases, with gene activity, you're in charge in terms of turning those genes up or down that can basically offset some of the susceptibilities you have that you don't want. Maybe you have a susceptibility toward drinking too much or toward anger. Now, in some cases, the genetics is very strong and it's very difficult to overcome it. There are certain, that's the exception rather than the rule. But in most cases, you can just simply how you live your life is altering your gene activity as well. So you're not just stuck with who you're going to be based on the cards you were dealt from your parents. There is quite a bit of wiggle room there to overcome that as well. So whether you're talking about the brain, neuroplasticity, as we call it, in the brain allows you to rewire. Epigenetics allows you to overcome some of the gene traits you have that you don't like. Not all of them, but most of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think Dr. Rudy Tanzi and Deepak Chopra are making groundbreaking discoveries, but I wonder how your fellow colleagues at Harvard University view your take on epigenetics. Are they into it? Do they think you have some research to do? How do they take that?
It's controversial. I mean, just writing a book with Deepak, as an academic, you know, I'm vice chair of neurology at Mass General, and I run a large research unit. And, you know, as an academic, whenever you write a book, a popular book, you're going to get ready for a little bit of criticism because the academic world is a little bit more, conservative. So especially writing a book with someone like Deepak Chopra, I thought, hey, Deepak and I have a lot to do together. We love looking at this, at the mix of the science and spirituality, the brain, you know, the spiritual side, the scientific side. And so, I have tenure. I have an endowed chair. I have that level of security. I worked this hard in my life to get to this point that I can write a book with Deepak Chopra, and if someone doesn't like it, I'm still going to have my job. And, so I thought, why not take advantage of that? When it comes to epigenetics, it's weird. It's very controversial. I mean, there's no doubt about epigenetics. There's no doubt that we modify our gene activity. You can even change your gene activity permanently. By a certain way you live your life, you can change a gene to be up or down for your own good, even permanently, because the gene itself gets chemically modified. And there's also evidence in other species. We haven't seen it in humans yet, but you assume what's happening in other species happens in us. That new things, this is mind-blowing, new gene changes that you make during your life, like modifying a certain gene, can actually be passed on to the next generation, which is the most controversial part. So in other words, if in your, like, there was the Dutch famine back in the 40s, and these people were starving, and the next thing you know, they all had children that were predisposed to obesity. So somehow the belief is that these people made modifications in their genes without knowing it because they were so hungry that gene activity allowed them to get more calories, for the food they took in, they got more bang for their buck, right? They took on more calories, and they were able to store more of those calories. So then when the kids were born, those kids who were now living in a world without famine were prone to obesity and diabetes. So this research is just beginning now, and this is what we're going to cover in the new book, of how changes in your genes as you live in response to your lifestyle not only can occur permanently by modifications to the genes, but get passed on to the next generation. So you're evolving in one generation. That's
pretty
mind-blowing.
It is, and I have two teenage nieces who don't have wisdom teeth. Is that because now they just pull them if you have them? Is that part of gene modification?
You're changing – anytime you're changing something in the body that's going to change activity, change behavior, or change how you live in your world, that's changing gene activity. And this is just a new realization that when you're changing the activity of your genes with how you live your life, even how you think about your life, that this can lead to permanent changes. And at least according to in mice and in other lower organisms below mice, you're seeing that can be inherited. So the Darwinian evolutionary people, right, the people who just, more or less, not so much biologists, but there are people who are, hardcore Darwin evolutionists who say it's all random, it's all just natural selection, and there's nothing you can do, and it's a bunch of woo-woo and hopeful thinking that you can change your genes, and they get very upset to think that you have any control whatsoever over your genetics. They attack. They attack me and Deepak about this. They attack the epigeneticists about this. These are names of people, like Richard Dawkins and people there are people like Jerry Coyne and Dennett at here in Boston. And they get very, very upset at these discussions.
Why is that? Why are they so defensive about it?
I honestly don't know. Maybe it goes back to childhood. But it's odd that evolutionary biologists who love Darwin don't want to hear about something that's with Lamarck, right? Lamarck was the other, you know, there's two sides, right? Darwin said it's all natural selection. It takes a long, long time for us to evolve. And the other side of the coin, Lamarck said, hey, this can happen right away. You can change what's happening in your genes right away. And now we're seeing they were both right. It's a combination of both, because you can change your gene activity, and at least according to lower species, pass it on. As a scientist, I'm always just saying, show me the proof and do the experiments. But you know, if you want to do the coolest experiments that drive science forward, you have to have some imagination. You have to allow yourself to think out of the box, you know, and not just pen yourself in. So I'm not going to say I believe any of this stuff for sure yet. I'm not going to say I believe right now that humans can pass on, you know, new gene activities to their young just because we've seen it in mice or water fleas. But you certainly have to explore it. And that's what science is about.
Well, can you do it, change your own genes right now?
Well, you can't change the DNA sequence that you have from your parents right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you can modify those genes chemically so you can modify their activity right now. So in other words, how you live your life is modifying activity of genes, and if it's done repetitively, that can become a permanent change. And in certain cases, modifying gene activity can help you to offset some susceptibility you have to a disease that your parents passed on to you. That's the idea.
See, now, I think that is mind-blowing. I think, because when I go to the doctors and they say, tell me your family health history, I say, just write doomed. So anything I can do to change and improve my genes, I think would be, life-changing for everybody.
Yeah, well, you're doing it with your outlook on life. I mean, you know, you're doing it already. We have a study we're about to submit, biggest of its kind, where we looked at the effects of de-stressing and also meditation on gene activity. So this was looking at all the genes in the body, and we looked at what is the effect of going to a nice resort and relaxing for a week have on your gene activity. And furthermore, what if you're at that resort and you're an advanced meditator or even a novice meditator, and you're meditating all that week and really finding the quiet of the mind and really maximally de-stressing. And the results are just astounding. And, you know, we did this with top people, Eric Schott at Mount Sinai, who's probably the top gene expression, gene activity guy in the world, Elizabeth Blackburn, who won the Nobel Prize for finding the anti-aging enzyme, telomerase, and her colleague, Alyssa Appel. And first thing we saw is that we saw increases in that anti-aging enzyme. We saw increases in genes that promote wound healing. In other words, as you get older, you know, it's always tougher to heal from a wound, right? You know, you look at a kid and they heal like in one day. You know, after 40 or 50 years old, it takes you a week to heal. So we're seeing the genes that control that are going up. You know, inflammation is a really bad thing for the body. We saw the genes that cause inflammation going down. And we saw this just by relaxing at a resort. In this case, they went to Deepak's Chopra Center at La Costa, where they have this whole lifestyle thing for healthier living that you learn and relaxation, and if you were meditating at the same time, the activity, these beneficial gene activity changes were 10 times greater. So it says there's a lot to, you know, that song "Don't Worry," you know, that worry,
right,
anxiety, and stress is the absolute worst thing for you. And frankly, when you're worrying and stressing out, it's the most profound example of your brain using you rather than using your brain. Worry and stress is part of the brain's way to keep the species going, because it keeps, with worry and stress, it makes sure that you don't do things that kill you. You know, by worrying and being paranoid and stressed out, you know, the brain, this is the way that the ancient instinctive brain is saying, make sure you still survive. Don't go outside. Oh, be very scared. Oh, just seek security. Don't do anything new, because then you might not live long enough to reproduce and our species will be gone. That's the old part of the brain that just got us this far. The new parts of the brain say, reach out, evolve, differentiate. And it's all about service, social interaction, bonding, love, as you say, living from the heart. That's where we're going.
I heard you in an interview when the book first came out, and you said a line that I use a lot, and I hope I'm saying it correctly. You said, tell your brain that everything is okay right now, and all we have is right now.
Yeah. Yeah, so that line also comes from the fellow I talked about who wrote these books that I talked about earlier, Subramanya Swami, who died, you know, one of my great influence on me. And it's such a great mantra to just say, whenever you're stressed out or scared or anxious and, you know, almost paralyzed with fear, there's only right now, right? The future isn't here yet. The past is gone. You're only right now. You know, there's a reason, like we like to say, there's a reason why we call it the present, because it's a gift. It's right now is a gift. It's the present. And right now, at this exact moment, everything's perfectly fine, right? The way to fight that fear and anxiety is to say, I am okay right now. I am okay right now. There's only right now. Breathe and say that. There's only right now, at any moment, there's only right now, and I'm okay right now. And now the brain will start to chill out, it will start to adjust, it will start to integrate, these brain areas connect, and now you make better decisions. You're more proactive, and you're not going to do foolish things or be paralyzed with fear.
Is it that simple? Can we tell our brain that, and our brain's going to respond?
Absolutely that simple. Your brain serves you. Your brain is an organ that's serving you, as long as you have self-awareness. And the brain is incredibly vulnerable to repetition. With repetition and persistence, your brain remodels itself. Your brain and your neural networks are physically remodeling, and they're remodeling according to what they hear in your mind. Right? It's a two-way street. Your brain is creating your brain. In other words, is creating your mind for you, but your mind, which is in control of the true self, call it the soul, call it what you wish, is then telling the brain what to be. So picture these two-way arrows, a circle of arrows going from brain to mind to brain. So with your mind right now, picture a sunset. Just picture a sunset on the beach. Picture the sun and what the clouds look like. Picture a beautiful sunset you saw recently or on vacation. And what are you doing? Your mind is now changing your brain. It's causing your brain to find those synapses, those recordings of that sunset, and reproducing them for you in your visual cortex. That's mind over brain in an instant. So you just expand
that
out to mind over... Yeah.
Is that easier to do for some people than others?
Well, you have to... Yes, because some can find their way to that mountaintop of self-awareness better than others. But as soon as you can get to that point where you say, and it can happen in an instant, right? As you can say, the real me is the user of my brain. The real me is simply the person, that self that realizes they have a brain. And you think about your brain as 3 pounds of jello, it's like jello, sitting in your skull, and it's an organ that's serving you and bringing you your world, and you're sitting back and saying, okay, brain, what are we going to do today? You're the inventor of your brain. You're its teacher, its guide, its ally, its best friend. You're working with your brain in harmony to say, what are we going to do today? And as soon as you get to that point where you're working with your brain and you're using your brain and you don't just have, you know, random parts of your brain using you to bring you either anger or paranoia or fear or stress, when you step back and say, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing? You know, you step back and turn it around and say, okay, brain, let's work this out. It's almost like thinking about your brain as your child, and you have to, if you try to control a child too much, then the kid's going to just do more of that, right? So we're not talking about controlling your brain, right? You're observing what's going on, and you're proactively working with your brain so that your brain brings you the world that you want to live in, because your entire world is projected to you by your brain.
We're talking to Dr. Rudy Tanzi, a Harvard researcher. Well, I do want to get to Alzheimer's in a minute because I know you've done a lot of work in there, co-author of the book Super Brain with Deepak Chopra. And part of something was mentioned in the book about nurturing Lila, is that your daughter, as a newborn?
Yeah.
And you said, you said you never let her cry. I have two wonderful sons, and because I'm such a heartfelt person, I could never let my kids cry, and I tried to attend to their needs, and I think that is a great way to do it. They're fine. I mean, some people, what is it, the Ferber method, that you're supposed to let your child cry it out? I couldn't do that. And
it's interesting you bring up that. You know, that part of the book, that section actually got edited out. And when I was reading the final draft, and I was like, hey, where did that go? And I insisted that go back in. And it's one of the things we talk about most in the book, so I'm so glad it went back in. But basically, and, you know, here's how, you know, in an infant, the brain is developing. So the entire foundation of the brain, the first neural connections, how the brain is producing this world that you're going to live in, right? The brain is always remodeling itself and producing this world you're living in. The first vestiges of that are in an infant, right? Those first neural connections are coming together to say, here's the world. Let me bring you the world. The brain's bringing the world now to this new little being, the infant. So, as you know, Deepak likes to say, it's going to either be a yummy world or a yucky world, right? I know, yummy world or a yucky world.
I've never heard him say that. I love that.
Yeah. So the question is, do you want your kid to grow up with a foundation in those first neural connections, that foundation of the brain, that at its base, the world's a good place or a bad place? And now, all through your life, as you learn new things, as you experience new things, the brain only does that, only learns new things by associating what's the new experiences with what already happened. Okay? So that's really important to remember. All experiences and all learning, the brain associates those experiences with what it already experienced. So all experience and learning is by association with what the brain already did in the past. So from the beginning, the brain's going to associate everything it experiences in the world, every sensation, everything you experience in the world is associated with what the brain already did. Now, the first things the brain does are when you're an infant, you're a newborn, it's the first day or the first week or first month, and the brain is creating your world. So we argue very simply, we wanted our little girl, Lila, to have a brain that says, this is a great world. Enjoy being in it. Love being in it. Now, if that baby's crying, that baby is a week old or a month old, crying in the night, and for 20 minutes, Dr. Ferber says, let the baby cry, okay? Well, you know, that baby is miserable. It's like, this world sucks. Oh, my God, I want to eat or I want to do this or whatever. There's some reason. And it's like, and I'm crying and my throat's starting to hurt. This is terrible. What kind of place is this? And the brain is creating now its first neural network saying, wow, welcome to hell, you know. So I just don't think that's a way to start a brain off. So
me either.
So that was a very simple decision for us, that when the baby cried, we went to the baby and said, it's fine. Don't worry about it. It gets better, you know. And, yeah, it's tougher on the parents, and you don't get much sleep, and you turn into a zombie, and you're at work spacing out. But, you know, it's only a couple of years, you know. It's only a year or so that you have to really go crazy that way.
See, that's what when I look around, and I try to look at what's right with the world. But when you look around and you see what's not right with the world, I see people, and they seem lonely and miserable and look unloved. And I have this new mantra, it all starts at home. And I just feel like if you're going to have a baby, then you need to be willing to sacrifice and nurture that child so they become a productive citizen in the world. So I totally love that I read that, and I'm glad they left it in the book because I couldn't agree more. And I'm here to tell you I have two sons, and I believe that really paid off, nurturing them and loving them and attending to their needs at any age, especially at an early age.
Well, yeah, because you created two sons who see the world as a good place. And so actually, you know, we were debating this. Deepak and I were on CNN in the morning show back with Soledad O'Brien, maybe a year or so ago, year and a half ago. And Soledad O'Brien, you know, when I was pointing this out because they brought it up, she said, well, you know, look, my dad, you know, it was different for us. You know, we weren't allowed to cry, and she was arguing with this with me about this approach, and said, you know, what's going to happen when the kids in preschool and a child throws a block at her head, and you know, and suddenly it's not such a rosy world anymore. And I said, well, what's going to happen is that she's not going to think it's the end of the world. She's not going to think this is a terrible place. Got to get hit with a block. She's going to look at this kid and still think it's, you know, the foundational neural network is going to say it's still a good world. Why did this kid throw a block at my head? And she's going to observe it but not react as badly to it because she's not starting off thinking that the world is terrible. So she's not going to snap. And this is when Deepak went off with the, you know, the idea of a yummy world versus a yucky world, and what, you know, how, what is the foundation of your brain. And but I mean, you can, there are people who are quite successful, obviously Soledad O'Brien, a very talented, successful person, but brought up in a different method and saying, well, it worked for her, and that's great. But because she had the right circumstances afterwards to become a very successful, happy person. But there are other people where if the world's, you know, they're brought up in a home that, where they think that, where the brain is saying that the world's a tough and terrible place, well, that's going to be your predisposition in life later on, and it's going to become a vicious cycle where you keep building on that, and you're miserable. And in some cases, that can even lead to pathological social behavior in the extreme cases, right?
Right. Well,
we would say,
left.
I agree with you. You suck it up, you know, that first year. Just be
right.
Ready to be a zombie. It's going to be the best thing you can do for your kid. That's what.
Yeah. Well, and you said she's 6 years old now. Is she buying this? Are you using your brain? Does that work on a six-year-old?
It actually is working. I mean, it's taking a lot of persistence. I have to remind her all the time. But when she gets angry, or when she's, you know, throwing a little temper flare, I just say, I said, Lila, are you using your brain right now, or is your brain using you? And I explain to her how her brain is actually what's bringing her to feel of anger. And I said, you like being angry? No. I said, well, that's your brain doing that. I said, think about the real you, that light inside. Can that light get angry? No. I said, then you know, go there. Go back there. And then now look at your brain and you know, and use your brain. If you don't want to be angry, just stop, because the real you is the person who stops it. And then she understands that. And we just got to keep – and so, you know, it takes time. It takes, again, repetition and persistence, but we're hoping this will serve her well, you know, in her later years after 6 years old.
I can't tell you how much I love that. You need to write a parenting book. I'm that's like my new thing, because that's just amazing. So, and you, I think you and I are close to the same age, late 30s, and can we use our brain for anti-aging?
Well, you know, aging, even aging, epigenetics, as I was saying, this you know, gene activity, how your genes are turned up or down in activity, contributes a lot to how you age. And basically, if you look at the centenarians, you know, the ones who have aged most successfully, and you ask them, you know, what do you think was the secret? By far and away, the most common answer among all of them is, don't worry. Let it go. De-stress. And I think that these people didn't really figure that out. They were probably genetically predisposed to a personality that said, let it go, de-stress, don't worry. But the killer, what really, you know, probably leads to the worst epigenetic states, because epigenetics can go both ways. It can also modify your genes for the worse rather than the better, right? Is that it's really stress. I mean, when you're worrying about stuff and you're stressed out, you actually produce a chemical in your brain called cortisol that kills nerve cells. So, I mean, stress and worry can physically kill nerve cells in your brain, which can contribute to bad aging of the brain, you know, to unhealthy aging of the brain. So, first and foremost, finding ways to not stress out and reminding yourself that you don't want your brain to use you, and that's the ultimate way the brain uses you, is worry and stress. It's evolutionarily programmed for our survival. Okay, this is probably number one. Of course, exercise, good diet, all of these are essential for healthy brain, healthy heart. But psychologically, don't stress out.
Do you meditate?
Yeah, so usually twice a day. And but nothing formal. I don't do any special thing. You know, my goal is just to, when I can, even when I'm not meditating, is quiet mind. Turn off that internal monologue. In other words, you know, so many of us live so much of the day having words in our head, right?
Right.
So words are great, right? Words are great. Language is great. We evolved with language. But there are only a certain number of words. I mean, I like to tell myself, do I want my whole life to be, every day I'm awake, to be run by laryngeal grunt sounds in my head? Right? Words. Right? We use our larynx to create these sounds that have meaning for us so we can communicate. And that's great for communicating with others, but internally, where there are infinite possibilities in my inner world, in my brain, in my mind, inside, do I want to also run my life with laryngeal grunt sounds I use to communicate with others? Not always. So that's the break I try to take, is turn off the words in my head and explore where, just navigate the mind. Say, you know, just see where I go. What feelings am I experiencing? Where am I going in my mind? And just kind of like go for a ride and turn off, just basically take off the shackles and handcuffs of laryngeal grunt sounds being reiterated in your head. Take a break. So that for me is meditation and something I try to do, you know, throughout the day.
Can you just tell yourself, can you just keep repeating, let it go, don't worry? If you just keep saying that to yourself whenever you stop and realize you're thinking,
yes.
Could that make a difference? Really?
Yes. The brain I'll emphasize, the brain is highly vulnerable to repetition. Repeating aphorisms like, I am okay right now, it's okay right now, there's only right now, let it go, don't worry, let it go. It sounds funny, but repetition gets it done because you remodel your neural networks according to those commands. And your brain believes everything you say. Your brain believes everything you say. So when you say, I am angry, and you keep saying, I am angry, well, I am depressed, right? I mean, when you get a cold, you get a cold, you say, I have a cold. But when you get depressed, you say, I am depressed. You wouldn't say, I am a cold. It's the same thing. It's a condition. So if you can teach yourself, just like you say, oh, I have a cold, it'll go away. I have a depression, it will go away. Rather than I am a very powerful word. The brain lives by I am. So wherever it is, I am, fill in the blank. Say that enough, and your brain remodels itself to be that. So use it toward your advantage. I am okay right now. I am not stressed. I am happy. And you remodel your brain to be that way.
Love it so much. And we have like 5 minutes left. And Dr. Rudy Tandy is our guest today. He's a renowned genetic researcher. In addition to all this great philosophy and look on life and things that we can do to improve our life, you've made extremely important discoveries concerning Alzheimer's. And it seems like I know so many people dealing with parents going through that. Any advice you can give them or advice you can give us from preventing it from happening?
Well, you know, I made my career discovering many of the known Alzheimer's disease genes, along with others. I co-discovered the first Alzheimer's gene back in the 80s and more in the 90s. And today I run the Alzheimer's Genome Project, and we're discovering many of the genes that influence risk for Alzheimer's. And basically, we take what we learn from those genes and we try to come up with new therapies and new drugs. And my lab is developing several new drugs to try to stop the disease and slow it down or even reverse it. But in terms of what can you do right now until we accomplish that goal of therapies, what can we do right now in lifestyle? You know, exercise is great for the brain. Physical exercise, you know, what's good for the heart is good for the brain, basically. A diet that's more of a Mediterranean diet. I'm personally a vegetarian, but you know, less red meat and more of a Mediterranean diet, fruits, nuts, you know, more fish than red meat, although I don't eat fish myself. You know, social interaction, staying socially engaged and bonding with others. Listening to a show like this, you're protecting people from Alzheimer's right now because learning new things, intellectual stimulation, making new synapses and connections in the brain, it's like having money in the bank because in the end, Alzheimer's is loss of those connections. So the more you make and the more you reinforce the ones you have by learning new things, Remember, learning is associating with what you already know. So when you learn new things, you not only make new connections, you reinforce and strengthen the ones you have. So intellectual stimulation. Those are the big four. So exercise, diet, social interaction, intellectual stimulation. And I would just add at the end, sleep. It's during sleep that you clear a lot of the stuff out of your brain that accumulates as you age that can cause problems. There's stuff like amyloid, and I won't get into the technical terms, but there's a lot of gunk, brain gunk, that accumulates as you age. And it's actually during sleep that you clear it out. I call that mental floss, where you're clearing stuff out of your brain. And there's so you only have that mental floss activity in the deepest part of sleep called slow wave sleep. And if you're not sleeping long enough, you may get REM, the dream sleep, but you may not get that deep slow wave sleep where the brain cleans itself out. So especially as you get older, insist on getting as close to 8 hours as you can, and no less than six. But, you know, even seven is a good goal. And finally, I would just say de-stress. Don't worry, because worry and stress is bad for your brain as well.
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to ask you this, but you hear a lot about coconut oil. Is that something that you believe helps?
So coconut oil provides an alternative energy source to the brain, right? So when, in order to make connections and synapses, so in order to fire, to have nerve cell activity in the brain, the firing in the brain that makes you aware and active, you have to have energy.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in Alzheimer's is that energy starts to go down. So you often hear of somebody having an ice cream cone or, you know, sugar, and they get a boost in that energy, and they're more alert and they're more aware for a while. Coconut oil provides an alternative energy source that, instead of using glucose as a sugar, it uses what's called anaerobic energy. And that alternate energy source can also spark up nerve cell activity and create, you know, periods of more alertness and awareness, so a loved one can have some time with the patient where they're more aware. So from what I've read, coconut oil helps with the symptoms in terms of, but it does. But there's nothing that I've read or nothing, there's no reason for me to believe that coconut oil is actually helping the brain to stop the disease. In other words, the disease is still going on. The brain is still deteriorating. There's no reason to believe coconut oil is stopping that, but it can make someone appear more alert and aware because of that energy source that's different from sugar, classic sugar.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, Dr. Rudy Tanzi. The book is Super Brain. I cannot thank you enough. This has been the best interview of my life, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share it with us today. And any way people to connect with you?
Well, I'm on Twitter. It's just at
we'll
Rudy
follow
Tanzi,
you there.
RudyTanzi, and I tweet quite a bit. And I have different websites and stuff online, but if you were to Google Rudy Tanzi, there's all kinds of fun stuff. So,
thank you so much, and good luck with your daughter. I think you're doing it correctly, and I appreciate it. We look forward to your next book as well.
And I think you're a great interviewer. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Aw, thank you very much, and come back anytime.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and that is today's inspiration. You can contact me at lisaloveberry@gmail.com, and I look forward to connecting with you next week. Thanks for listening.